Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast, along with Jim Callis from the home office in Winnetka, Illinois. I'm John Manuel. Thanks so much for joining us here, downloading us, whether it's at baseballamerica.com or on iTunes. I want to remind you that we're brought to you by the MLB Network, and you can get a special four issues for $4 deal. It's our special MLB Network offer. That's available at baseballamerica.com/MLB Network. And Jim, I can stop talking about your appearance on MLB Network and talk about my own. I was very happy to be on there Saturday at the Rising Stars game out in Arizona. That was a lot of fun. And got to spend an inning and a half on the air with Dave Valley and Darren Sutton, and that was a fun game. Kind of like the Futures game, but I think people need to remember that that's played in November, and most players are not at their best in November. But it was fun to see, good to see a lot of those players in person, and glad we did not have extra innings as Leslie Anderson ended it with a walk-off home run in the bottom of the ninth. Talk about the opposite of what you usually think about in a Rising Star or a Futures game or a 29-year-old Cuban defector. But I was glad Leslie Anderson was there because he kept us from going to 10 or 11 innings.
Would they have played extra innings? I know with the Futures game, they just don't have enough pitching. My understanding is with the Futures game, we would just end in a 9-9 tie.
They had what's called the Robinson rule. They kept talking about the Robinson rule. Their maximum was 11 innings. Mike Guerrero told us before the game, he's one of the managers, that they were planning for an 11-inning game. So that meant all their pitchers didn't get in. That meant they didn't all get in. But they only had one pitcher left, I think, when the game ended. So both teams went to their bullpens early and often. And it was some good things to see. I don't think you can read too much into it, but it's cool to see Mike Montgomery and Manny Benuelos as your two starters. It was cool to see Jeremy Jeffress at 101 miles an hour. It was very cool to see Brandon Belt play well and look good and a lot of talent in one place. And I think very disappointing to see that Bryce Harper was not there, but I did get a chance to see Harper play the night before, and I wrote an article about it at baseballamerica.com. It's free. It's on the Prospects blog. I recommend you check it out because I think it talks about something other than Bryce Harper's tools. It talks about his effort, and the makeup was questioned before the draft, Jim. And I didn't even plan on this being a podcast topic. But I'm going to tell you, after seeing him in the fall league, even if it was just one game, and talking to people out there about him, I don't think I would take Anthony Rendon ahead of Bryce Harper. I think we sold Bryce Harper's hit tool a little short, and I think we sold him a little short, to be honest with you. Trying to temper the hype, I almost feel like I almost went the other direction. If Bryce Harper had been in the 2011 draft and things go the way we think they're going to go and Anthony Rendon comes back healthy from his ankle injury and has a great year, I still think Bryce Harper's tools measure up better, and I think they measure up better by a decent amount, enough so that I think even though he's a right fielder versus a third baseman for Rendon, I think I'd take Harper over Rendon.
I think you could certainly debate it either way. I heard a lot of the same thing. And again, I mean, maybe there was some Harper backlash or even some Scott Boras backlash. But when we did talk to some scouts, you know, I think a number of them who – I don't think anybody questions that Harper is going to hit for power. And you hate when I do this, but I'll continue to label him the best power prospect in the draft era.
I don't hate when you do that because now you're proving my point. So now I'm on it.
I've said that all along. So, I mean,
you
I,
have.
Just
I've come around to your way of thinking.
There is going to be some swing and miss because I do think from what we've heard, he does have a swing that's geared toward power. But, that's the fun thing about prospect debates is I think you could defend either way. I still think, unless he's not healthy enough, Rendon gets to the big leagues first. And, I know you wrote about his work ethic. I don't think anybody's ever debated Harper's work ethic. I mean, you might almost describe his devotion to baseball as an obsession. I mean, it's almost too much maybe at times. I think the makeup issues were more just, about maturity questions, not so much that this guy isn't going to give you everything he has.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. He actually, that was part of the story in there, is that he, he was, looked like he's being a pretty good teammate. I guess I tweeted it, maybe I didn't put it in the story, but about how he was, wearing it good-naturedly. I think the thing that, that when other players on both teams were, he was coming off the field and fans were screaming for Bryce Harper for an autograph. So he just heard a lot of Bryce, Bryce from the stands. And then basically all 50-some players in the field started yelling, Bryce, Bryce. It was really, it was fun to watch. And he just kind of wore it with a smile, which I think he kind of had to do. But, know, I mean, you can definitely overdo it, but the scouts I talked to out there who'd seen him, pretty impressed to a man. And I think that the other thing there is I think that guy's going to get to the big leagues pretty quick. Just looking at him on the field with Arizona Fall Leaguers, he did not look out of place in any way, in any shape, in any form. Not in terms of tools, not in terms of size, not in terms of how he carried himself. He fit right in. Wouldn't stun me if he had a huge 2011. Honestly, I think he probably goes in as my, you know, it's going to be a difficult meeting. I can already foresee him versus Mike Trout as the number one prospect in the minor leagues because I've taken over Mike Trout too. But I just think the impact there is, impact potential is immense. And I think it's, I really do think on my part, I think I was guilty of overcompensating in the other direction, trying to tamper down some of the hype. So I won't speak for you, but I think I did a little bit because I think there's no way this guy's just a 50 hit tool. This guy's a 60 hitter, if not better. And he's a 60 runner, maybe a 65 runner. When you get comparisons to him to Larry Walker with more power, that's a future Hall of Famer. That's what that is. So that's the kind of player I think he can be. So that was eye-opening in the fall league. And it really stuck out. He stood out on the field. And for an 18-year-old, a guy should be a high school senior to do that in the fall league among all those prospects, I thought was pretty outrageous. And I'm almost convinced that if he'd been in the Rising Stars game, a few more people would have watched. I think that would have been an easy call. It's too bad that Fall League did not take advantage of that. Jim, we're here to talk about other stuff, though. We could wrap up the World Series. We could talk about the Red Sox and Yankees top tens. We did both of those. Of course, you did the Red Sox. I did the Yankees. How many years now, spanning your two stints at Baseball America, have you done Red Sox top 10 or top 30 prospects?
Huh, that's interesting. Because, you know, I've done them. I've done the last, I guess, 11. Yeah, ever since we've done the Prospect Handbook, we're on the 11th edition, I've done the Red Sox Top 30. And I did them for a number of years. You know, I don't know when I did my first one, but it was probably 5 or 6 years before that. So I've probably done 15 or 16 years of Red Sox Top 10 / Top 30s.
Were you doing the list when Donnie Sadler was number one, not bagging on you for Donnie Sadler?
I did. And what's funny is, I mean, if you go back and look, I mean, I know that one looks weird, but it's every time I start to feel bad about that, I go back and look at who was there, and I think I made the right decision at the time. I mean, that was we'll just use innuendo.
Oh, I'm not trying to bag.
Garcia Parra was not the Nomar Garcia Parra who was bursting shirtless off the cover of Sports Illustrated a few years later.
Correct.
And guys viewed him as a defensive-oriented guy without much pop, which is, you know, he probably weighed about 170 pounds at the time.
He was almost looked at kind of like an Adam Everett type, wasn't he?
I think people thought he'd hit. They thought he'd hit and be a good defender. They just, nobody saw he'd hit for the kind of power he had. And, you know, Sadler had a tremendous year in low A ball, was a very dynamic shortstop, and he played, you know, and he stole a bunch of bases. And I think he had more offensive upside. What happened that wound up killing Donnie Sadler was the next year they jumped him a couple levels and tried to move him to center field.
Right.
And he never recovered. They just asked him to do too much. And so I don't think we ever saw what Donnie Sadler might really have become. He just kind of got rushed and bounced around. But I think Jeff Suppan and Trot Nixon were also in that top four. And Sadler obviously had the worst career, but, you know, at the time, I mean, you know, Nomar looked like a good defender with a, you know, solid bat. And, you know, Trot couldn't stay healthy. And Suppan was like a number three starter. And, you know, Sadler was like a guy who might win a Major League stolen base title. So,
he still somehow.
That was me. So I was doing at least as far back as that.
Donnie Sadler still played parts of 8 seasons in the big leagues, albeit with a career 546 OPS. But still, for a 5'6" dude, I mean, that's pretty impressive. That's a pretty impressive, pretty amazing career. Let's talk about this year's Red Sox and Yankees top 10. This is my 6th year of doing Yankees top 10s. I think my first year was 05 when Eric Duncan was number one, so that's a little bit worse than Donnie Sadler. I don't think Eric Duncan's getting 8 years in the big leagues, no matter what. He's now in the he spent last year in the Braves organization. So everybody has their hits and misses. Number two on that list, Robbie Cano. Definitely thought that Robbie Cano would be a good big league player. I think both of us are a little bit surprised at how good he's become. And, you know, I don't think anybody saw him, even the Yankees, I don't think saw him becoming an MVP caliber hitter. Do you think either? I think it's easy to say the best prospect in either of these two organizations is Jesus Montero, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's pretty easy to say. I mean, I guess I'm throwing superlatives around left and right. I think Montero, of all the hitters in the minor leagues right now, is the best all-around hitter. I think he's going to hit for a ton of average and a ton of power. I'm still not sold by any means that he's going to be a catcher long-term.
Yeah, I agree.
Although I think if you want to dream a little bit, I mean, he could maybe, why couldn't he have a Mike Piazza-like career back there? I mean, Mike Piazza, I think if Montero can get a little bit better as a receiver, that could work. I mean, Mike Piazza didn't throw anybody out, but he provided so much offense, you came out ahead of the game. And, I think Montero, I think tools-wise could be a better defender than Piazza was and be that same type of high average, big home run type of guy, especially in Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, I agree. No, I agree completely. I think he's got opposite field power in spades, which really will suit him very well to Yankee Stadium. I think defensively, this sounds horrible, but how much worse can he get than Jorge Posada is right now?
No, I agree. I mean, Posada's not very good right now. I mean, and, sometimes, the light, maybe it takes, getting to the big leagues and maybe not playing as much as you want because your defense isn't where it needs to be to light a little fire under him, too. I mean, I'm not saying that that's necessarily the case with Jesus Montero, but, we're talking Yankees Red Sox prospects. Hanley Ramirez was a much harder worker and better player in the big leagues than he ever was in the minor leagues.
And that's a great point. That's a great point, Jim. I think you're on it.
And, I think sometimes you can tell a guy, hey, you got to get better, but until you come up to the big leagues and maybe you're playing three times a week and sitting behind Posada and Cervelli, that it doesn't hit home quite as much.
And don't forget,
the best option for next year, you allude to, I mean, Posada's defense is terrible right now also, is I would just take all three of those guys and let them all catch about a third of the games, and you can mix and match how you want, and then let Posada and Montero get the bulk of the time at DH, and, that way maybe Montero gets, 350, 400 at-bats in the big leagues and, catches 50, 60 games behind the plate. I just don't see any point in putting him back in the minor leagues.
I agree, and I think your point about, because I wrote about it actually in the number one write-up, is that the Yankees believe that happened for Robbie Cano. He got better around big league instruction, and a lot of that big league instruction came from other Yankees, and I think they think the same thing could happen with Montero. And then don't forget Tony Pena, Joe Girardi, obviously Girardi the manager, Pena also on that staff, both former big league catchers, both noted for their defensive ability. That's only going to help. Girardi spent a lot of time in spring training working with Montero. That improvement took and maybe faded away a little bit. Girardi would be in his ear all the time now that Girardi's locked up again. So I'm with you. I think Montero will never be an average defender behind the plate. But you can live with a 40 catcher if he hits the way we think Montero could hit. And he could be an extremely offensive catcher.
I think about him. I mean, maybe another parallel of a guy who's in the big leagues right now, but I think he can be a better player than this guy who's been a multiple-time All-Star, is Victor Martinez. I mean, Victor Martinez is like he can't throw me out right now stealing bases. And Victor Martinez, and I think Montero's upside, again, I mean, we're not saying he's a guarantee to get there, but I think his upside is to be a better offensive player than Victor Martinez.
I agree. The one reason, and I think we never hear those comparisons, is that Montero actually has arm strength as opposed to, to Martinez or Piazza. I think the receiving is the bigger issue, and also the handling of pitchers, and that's going to be, that's going to be a factor. And the Yankees are spending a lot of money on pitchers right now. A.J. Burnett clearly needs to be handled with kid gloves, and that guy's under contract till he's, 36 with the Yankees? And there's talking about spending a lot of money on Cliff Lee. So, Cliff Lee, if you're not getting him a couple of extra inches off the black, command is what he's all about. If you're costing him strikes because you can't handle it, and you can't handle him, you can't receive well enough, you're not going to stick behind the plate because Cliff Lee's the big investment there, not you. So he's going to have to get better at receiving, but I think he's going to be good enough with the offense that he brings. I think the Yankees, I think these organizations are always going to get compared to each other, Jim, by their franchises and their fans. I think, is it fair to say that in our assessment of their top 10s, either top 10 blows us away. They're both solid top 10s. I think the Yankees have a little bit stronger top 10 because it's because of Montero, because they have up the middle talent, excuse me, with three catchers, and then both organizations have are better depth than they have top tens, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I think we've always found that we're maybe more. I think we're more extreme towards organizations we do. Like, if you're doing an organization that has talent, you tend to think maybe it's better than it is. And if you're doing an organization that's bad, you tend to think it's worse than it is. Although I still remember, who was it, like Matt Eddy and Aaron Fitt, you know, having this big argument about who was worse, the Padres or Nationals a few years ago.
That's right.
I mean, neither one of them deserved to be number 30. They both thought that their team was much better than that. But I guess my perception, and maybe I'm a little looking through it through Red Sox colored glasses since I do the Red Sox list, is I think the Yankees have a better farm system right now than the Red Sox. Although I think the, not necessarily you, but I think the perception of fans is that the Yankees farm system is better than I actually think it is. And I think that the perception is that the Red Sox farm system is worse than I think it is.
I think that's fair. I think you're right. The perception out there is that there's a big gap.
Very heavy pitching-wise, you know, once you get past Montero and Gary Sanchez, and very little in the way of position players that do a lot for me. With any pitchers, I mean, you know, I still, you know, Betances and Brackman a year ago wouldn't have been anywhere close to top 10. And then you flip it over to the Red Sox, and, you know, I think they're much deeper, even though their number one prospect is a pitcher, they stand out more, I think, for their position player depth than they do for their arms. Like, if you were doing if we were doing an exercise where you did the top, say, 15 position players between the two systems, you might have 10 Red Sox on there. And if you're doing the top 15 arms between the two systems, you'd probably have 10 Yankees on there right now.
That's a good way to put it, too. I agree. I mean, if you ask me which one I'd rather have pitching prospects, though. Yeah, if I had to choose, I think both those teams can go out and trade for or buy hitters. And I think the golden, you know, the thing that you really want to do the most as an organization is develop pitching. That said, you know, how many of the Yankees pitchers are going to pitch for the Yankees? And I think those top three guys, Betances, Banuelos, and Brackman, all have a chance to do that. I think on any given day, you know, you take any of those three guys as the Yankees' top guy. I think Banuelos is the safest bet. I think he's left-handed. That also helps. I think Betances has the best stuff. I think Brackman has a notch below Betances in terms of stuff, better athleticism, which should mean better command. He was in the top 10 last year, by the way, even after his awful year. We kept Brackman in the top 10 last year because of the upside, and he showed it this year, especially in the second half. But the other thing with Brackman is, you know, the sum is not as, you know, does not equal the whole of the parts. He should be better than he is the feeling a lot of scouts get. So a guy with two pitches that are pushing 70 should have a lot more strikeouts than Brackman, a guy with that kind of athletic ability. And they have a lot of guys. I think all three of those guys are Yankees profile guys, but then you have the Adam Warrens and the Hector Noeses and the Ivan Novas and the Brent Marshalls and the Graham Stoneburners and the David Phelpses and the DJ Mitchells. And we've got all kinds of guys like that who really, you know, for the Yankees, the $200 million payroll, those guys are middle relievers or fifth starters. And, you know, I think Adam Warren we'd be a lot more excited about if he was a Pittsburgh Pirate. You know, if he was on the Pirates organization, Adam Warren would probably be in their top 10. If he was in a lot of organizations, he'd be in their top 10. But he'd still profile really more as a number 4 type starter. I think that's the ceiling there. Maybe a 3. But more than likely for the Yankees, he's going to be a middle reliever or a fifth starter. So, you know, in terms of value, I think I agree with you. There's not as big of a gap between those two organizations as I thought. Jim,
and I think you're right too, John. I mean, that you can, what you're saying about the Yankees, you can say about the Red Sox too, is that a lot of these players are going to have more value to other organizations than they will to the Yankees and Red Sox, because
right,
those teams are in it to win it every year. They're not rebuilding. They're not going to take a year off. I mean, I know Theo Epstein got a lot of heat for referring to this as a bridge year, and I don't think he was ever saying we aren't going to try to win. He was just saying, you know, we're kind of, you know, resetting a little bit for the future. You know, we've got some young talent. It wasn't, you know, we're giving up on 2010. But, you know, these guys are going to have a hard time cracking lists. You know, Felix Dubron is a, you know, a lefty who's got, you know, solid stuff, and he pitched well in the big leagues. And I think a lot of organizations, you know, you'd be talking with optimism, oh, you know, Felix DeBrant could be in the rotation next year or this and that.
Right.
You know, Felix DeBrant might be, you know, the number one lefty reliever in Boston's bullpen next year. He's gotten a chance to crack the rotation right now. And, you know, he's a guy who didn't qualify for the list. And I don't think he's a top prospect. But, you know, Ryan Kalish, to me, you know, has a chance to be a solid regular.
Right.
But he's not going to get that chance in Boston, probably. You know, they're talking about going out and getting a Jason Worth or a Carl Crawford. They've
right.
already got Ellsbury. They got Mike Cameron still under contract. You know, J.D. Drew's scheduled to get another year in his contract. So, cool. You know, you just it's tough unless you have injuries for both those teams or you have a guy who's just a really, really standout prospect. The team is not going to give you, you know, 2 years and 1,000 at-bats to grow into a starting role. You need to be able to produce at a very high level right away, or you're just not going to get an opportunity to do that much in Boston or New York.
I don't think it ever hit home, Jim, but just how much money the two top 30s that you do, because you do Red Sox and Cubs. Those are two tough organizations to rank because, you know, it's not like the Twins where if you profile as a third or fourth starter, like they're excited about you. If you're a fourth starter, you could be the number one guy. Nick Blackburn was a couple of years ago. It's a little bit different deal when you're ranking teams with $100 and $200 million payrolls. But both the clubs you do top 30s for have those giant payrolls. And really, the profile really matters in both those organizations.
Yeah, the difference, I think, is I don't think the Cubs spend their money at the major league level as well as the Red Sox do. They kind of
You don't say.
we're spending out of desperation, so they've got a bunch of guys with bad contracts. So I think, you know, I know when we rank these, again, we don't downplay these guys compared to other organizations because they're not necessarily going to make it with their, you know, with their current big league organization. You kind of have to project, you know, what's this guy's value on a typical major league club, not, you know, is he never going to play for the Yankees? But it's just, you know, I guess it hits home when you're writing about the future. You know, like for instance, another guy like Josh Reddick with the Red Sox, who, you know, has, you know, I think across the board, you know, average, you know, I don't know how many plus tools he has, but he's probably average to slightly above average across the board.
He's a great example.
He can play center field. So for a lot of, you know, shoot, if, I mean, here in Chicago, he'd probably be playing center field for the Cubs or the White Sox, or at least get a long look. And with the Red Sox, you know, he's had a couple opportunities, and it seems like unless he's playing against the Orioles, he just hasn't hit a whole lot. And he's the type of guy who puts a lot of pressure on himself, so when things don't go well, they kind of snowball him a little bit. Well, he's had a couple opportunities to play in Boston, not, you know, extended, but he's gotten a couple opportunities and hasn't produced. And now, you know, we were just talking about Kalish. I don't even know how Josh Reddick makes the big league team next year. And, you know, this is a guy who hit pretty well the last 2 months in AAA and just hit throughout the minors, and he's just kind of trapped. And so, you know, a lot of these guys, you wind up, you know, going back and looking, and it seems they wind up getting used in trades.
Yeah, and it does that's one of the things I kept encountering talking to scouts who have coverage of the Yankees was, hey, look, they're very well set up for trades. And that was meant as a compliment by everybody. So, and that means the Yankees are doing their job. And it's interesting. I think the Yankees system had a terrible year in 2009. As bad a year as they had in 2009, they had a very good year in 2010. And that doesn't get any attention, nor should it really, when you have a $200 million plus payroll and you look as old as they did in the postseason. Speaking of the postseason, we haven't even really wrapped up the World Series on the Baseball America podcast. Jim, I don't know, obvious congratulations to the Giants. Did you ever do a Giants top 10 back in the day? You ever ranked Marcus Jensen number one?
I think I did it for four or five. I think I ranked Marcus Jensen about five different years when we only did 10. He made the top 10 for about 5 years in a row. So
he's now their Arizona League manager,
I believe. In my first stint at Baseball America, they were one of my organizations I did for several years.
You were getting ready to write a bump with the St. Petersburg Giants back then.
Probably, yeah.
It came close to happening. But and I did the Giants when we first started doing the handbook. I did the Giants, I think, for the first 5 years of the handbook. Did them recently enough to rank Pablo Sandoval. So it's been fairly recent. Not recently enough to rank.
He's probably under 250 pounds at the time.
So. He was. As a matter of fact, the first time I ranked him, he was 5'11", 180, and we described him as an ambidextrous catch-and-throw specialist.
I'm questioning the 180 in retrospect, but
I think you're
like
right.
12, but.
I wonder if he's actually, I question the 245 now. So put it that way.
Yeah, I think the 245 is probably kind.
It's always the fat guy making fat jokes.
He just meant he could eat with either hand, right?
That's a good one. I like that. But yeah, so obvious congratulations to the Giants. Jim, you had the question in Ask BA. I wrote a column about it, kind of a historical perspective, really. of the Giants, those three first round draft picks in a row, Lincecum 06, Bumgarner 07, Posey 08, it certainly would be fun to play what if and what would have happened if Lincecum had gone to other teams in 2006. I think you and I have more frequently talked about the what if in 2005. What if the, you know, any team had met his $1 million request as a sophomore eligible out of UW?
And what if he had a great cape?
He had a great cape. What if the Indians? Yeah, what if the Indians had gone ahead and signed him that summer?
But he even got beamed by a line. He got hit in the head by a line drive and came back and had tremendous numbers. And I can't remember the exact amount. I've heard different numbers over the years. But, you know, the Indians drafted him, and I've heard they offered him either $500,000 or $800,000, but they wouldn't go to the full million. And, you know, obviously that would have been it. But, you know, people do the what-if with Tim Lincecum. I don't really think there were any teams ahead of the Giants seriously considering taking
him. I agree. No, that's why I think it's useless to
play
that.
There was talk. You know, and it's funny now because I remember it a little differently. You know, there was a story came out in the World Series, and I can't remember who wrote it. It was probably before the World Series that the Rangers were poised to take Tim Lincecum. He was their guy. I also remember being told at the time that even if he was there, that they really wanted a left-hander and were leaning towards Casey Kiker. Because I remember, and this will make you laugh, it might have been the day, I guess that was before the draft was on TV. So I would have been home. I think I ran out to get like McDonald's at like 11 a.m. or so, or early in the afternoon, whatever it was, like a very quick lunch. And Jamie Newberg of the Newberg Report called me to find out if I thought they would take Lincecum. And I said, I keep hearing they'll take Casey Kiker if he's there. And Jamie was just apoplectic that they were, you know, would pass on Lincecum. But it's funny. I'm sure there definitely are more teams now who will claim, hey, we were all over the guy than there were at the time. But, you know, I think we ranked him number two on overall draft board behind Andrew Miller.
Andrew Miller was one and Brad Lincoln was three. So that top three, two out of three is not good, but the one that we got right, we got right.
But I just don't think I can't recall any of the teams in front of him really being on Lincecum, and it wasn't that he was asking. I think he signed for $2 million, which would have been right around slot. I don't think it was a money thing at that point. I just think there were number 10, and I think there still would be today that an unorthodox, smallish right-hander. You're going to have teams, you know, everybody wants their first round pick to look the part, and they're just are not, you know, you got to give the Giants, I think, the most credit for, they just really don't care what other people think. You know, they don't talk to other teams about what they're going to do in the draft. They take the guy they want, and they don't really care what other people think. So I think the Giants are, they may not be, you know, year in, year out, the best drafting team, but, you know, they're not afraid to go with what they think.
That's pretty much it. That's how I feel about it. And Madison Bumgarner, another one. I just was reading, cleaning out some old emails the other day and found one. I don't remember who I was emailing to, but it was the night after I'd gotten back from seeing Bumgarner in high school. Got a John Smiley comp on him that night, which is pretty funny to think about. John Smiley had a couple of really good years. I mean, he won 20 games one year. He was a playoff rotation starter a couple times with what I guess was Minnesota or Pittsburgh. I guess maybe it was Pittsburgh. And then Cincinnati in 1995 after some injuries. But the implication being a guy, a left-hander who could really pitch off his fastball and then have tremendous secondary stuff. Always been a Bumgarner fan. Very excited to see Madison Bumgarner pitch as well as he did in the World Series. And, you know, I think the question there is then looking forward from that World Series, what does the future really hold for the Giants and the Rangers? I don't really see the Giants changing their methodology at all, Jim. They're going to stick with starting pitching. They got four guys they can afford now. They'll probably, you know, have to pony up, obviously, to keep Kane and Lincecum. I can see them doing that. I can see them letting Sanchez being the guy they trade and keeping Kane and Lincecum, seeing as how they're tied in to Barry Zito and Bumgarner's cheap and young and obviously has a pretty high ceiling. Do you see them changing anything with their methodology? Do you see them getting smarter about developing hitters? With Buster Posey now this year, the breakout season by Brandon Belt. How do you see the Giants' immediate future?
I think they're going to have to continue doing what they're doing just because of the way their major league team's structured. I mean, it's going to have to be pitching heavy. Their best players are almost all pitchers, at least the guys are going to have to invest in. The thing is, I mean, besides Belt and you know, Belt has made, Brandon Belt has made great strides this year. And I'll give, you know, the Giants, you know, adjusted his stance and he really took off. I don't know that they have a whole lot of other hitters who are really going to step in and make any kind of significant impact for him. They're going to kind of have to do what they did this year, which is kind of create a lineup. You know, they got Aubrey Huff as a bargain free agent. You know, he's a free agent again. You know, Pat Burrell was released and played out of his mind for him. Andres Torres had by far the best year of his career.
Not even close.
You know,
amazing.
Juan Uribe, you know, was part of another championship team. I mean, it wasn't a very imposing lineup. You know, I will see what they do with Huff and Burrell. I'm not really sure they're going to put up those same numbers again. I mean, you love Buster Posey, but, you know, they're going to, it looks like to me they've got, you know, right now on their roster, one hitter you really, really like, and then they're going to have to figure out an offense around him somehow.
Yeah, and
but I think
some,
with that park and the strength of the team, it plays towards pitching anyway.
I agree, and I think you know, their revenues will at least stay the same, if not go up, with their success. So I see them being able to spend, but I mean, the real question there is, will they learn some of the lessons in terms of spending? I mean, Aaron Rowan's contract. You know, I actually brought this up with a Giants official in the last couple months, and he asserted that was not a lost contract, just because even though Aaron Rowan hasn't played well, that he helped change the atmosphere in their dugout and their clubhouse. I don't know how much that's worth. They still overpaid him.
I don't know if that's worth $55 million.
Right. Obviously, Edgar Renteria paid off in that last couple of weeks with the World Series and the playoffs.
That's unbelievable, because, I mean, even though he played well in the World Series, that contract made no sense to me at the time.
Correct.
I mean, he didn't look like Vladimir Guerrero running around in right field, but man, I swear you can hear his joints creak when he tries to go in the hole to make a play at shortstop.
At least he could bend over.
Yeah, I mean, it's just he struggled out there. But, I mean, it's interesting because, in a way, I mean, I'm with you. You got to give them credit. You know, they made some great draft picks. I think I wrote my column in the current issue about this, John. You know, everybody talked about, and rightfully so, you know, Lincecum and Posey and Bumgarner. But what they all, you know, they had Justin, they, you know, also had Matt Cain, but they also had four guys they drafted after the 20th round on that team, too.
Right.
Three of whom played major role. You know, they had Brian Wilson, who was a Tommy John guy, who they took even though he was just coming off surgery. And, you know, they found Jonathan Sanchez and Sergio Romo. And it's funny because I was just reading, you know, Sports Illustrated touched on that, too. And then they were talking there about how, I think it was Dick Tidrow was talking about how Sanchez, you know, they got him late because he didn't put up good results and college. Well, I mean, shoot, the guy threw four no-hitters in college.
I read that article, too, and I was reading that in the airport. I was like, that is bull. He went 11-0 as a junior.
It was funny because it's like, I mean, and I just read a column on it before I read the article, and it said, you know, the thing was people didn't like his delivery. He kind of pushed the ball, and I think his stuff was, they just weren't sure how it was going to play at the big league level or in pro ball. They didn't like his delivery, but the area scout just said, look, this guy's got a very good arm. We can, you know, we can change the delivery and there'll still be something good there. But so anyway, I mean, I guess the thing I was trying to say before I started babbling about their low round picks, John, was in a way I almost think their win almost gives false hope a little bit to some teams that, you know, you can build this great pitching staff and then, you know, have another, you know, very mediocre offense and win. Because one, I don't think it's real easy to build a great pitching staff.
Agree.
And two, I mean, they outplayed everybody in the playoffs. They beat teams people didn't think they were going to beat. They deserved it. You know, my hat's off to them. I just don't know if the playoffs, if they redid the playoffs starting today, if I pick them to win looking at that offense. I just don't think it's that easy to do. And just like in some ways, I think some people looked at the Rays when they got to World Series, and if you're a small revenue team, you know, okay, you know, look, they did it on a small payroll, you can do this. Well, the Rays built a tremendous farm system. It wasn't those things are easier said than done. You know, I think it offers hope when it's not the Yankees or the Red Sox or whoever, you know, the Phillies spending $150 million-plus and winning the World Series. You know, it offers hope to the teams that don't operate that way. But at the same time, I just don't know how easy it is to duplicate what the Giants have done. I don't know how easy it is to duplicate what the – you know, what the Rays have done. I mean,
I'll disagree with you.
I'm in the process of doing that now, but you also, you really do have to hit on a lot of your guys, too.
I'll disagree with you on that, though, because, you know, 9 of the last 10 years, baseball's had a different World Series champion. So I think it is doable.
I'm not
doable.
Saying there are different ways to win it. I just think...
I think it is doable. I think that the Giants model is a more difficult model than the Rays. Because I think the Rays have paired good scouting and player development with an intelligent approach to getting free talent and free agents and that kind of thing at the major league level. whether it's Joaquin Benoit or getting Carlos Pena off the scrap heap a couple of years ago and riding that for as long as they could. I think that it's harder to sustain. There's no doubt. I think the Rays model is more sustainable than the Giants model. Let's not forget the gap in revenue there between the Giants and the Rays is very significant. With the Giants, we're talking about a team that, we mentioned Rowan and Renteria. At least those guys were on the postseason roster, better than Barry Zito can say. He wasn't even on any of the three postseason rosters. At the time, it was the biggest contract ever for a pitcher. And he doesn't even make their postseason roster. He's a fifth starter. He's a good fifth starter because he's durable and he's basically league average. But he's a fifth starter. So I think the Giants could be this good without spending as much money as they have spent. I just think their method is harder because it's very hard. I honestly think their method actually validates what you and I talk about all the time, which is stars. You win with stars. And in their case, they won with stars. Star first-round picks, Kane, Bumgarner, Lincecum, and one star in the lineup in Buster Posey. It's harder to do that because we just looked at it, and in the column we talked about it, and you talked about it in SBA, how rare it is to keep hitting on first-round picks. But, the Angels' method was pretty similar back in 2002. They got lucky with some guys in the bullpen, but they had a lot of high draft picks that they accreted over time. I've been watching a lot of space stuff lately, so I'm going to use the word accreted. They just pulled in one or two pieces at a time, but over 5, 6, 7 years, boom, they got hot. They got hot in August and September, and then October, and they won it. In the Giants' case, they got hot really in September. They were unbelievable on the mound in September, and they gave up more than 4 runs twice the entire month of September and October in the regular season. And then once or twice in the playoffs. So I think they actually proved our star theory. They validated that theory that you win with stars and not depth. But it is a harder way to go because you've got to make sure you hit on all those picks. But they have Dick Tidrow. And Dick Tidrow is a great evaluator of pitching, and it showed in the World Series. Let's move on to some of our podcast questions. We have lots of questions this week at podcast@baseballamerica.com. We'll start off with a regular, of course, Joe LeCate. We've got 4 questions, if not 5 questions, Jim. So let's.
I got a few on my end, too. So we'll go through yours and we'll run through mine, and maybe we'll wrap it up at that point.
Sounds good. Perhaps an overly simplistic question asked Joe, but in light of Pat Murphy being on his way to manage short season Eugene next year, what is the reason we do not see more amateur managers or coaches hired by professional operations? Jim, I would argue that college coaches make more money now and minor league managers, and that's why they don't do it. It's an easier job, less travel, more money. It's kind of a no-brainer.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, you have more control of what you're doing. You make more money. You're the big cheese instead of the manager in short season ball somewhere. I think when I started working at Baseball America in the late 80s, there was not a lot of respect between pro ball and college ball. A lot of the pro teams felt the college coaches didn't know what they were doing. They were ruining pitchers. And I think now there's a lot more respect for it. You see sometimes guys, maybe get tired of coaching and go into scouting or go into things here and there. But you're right. I mean, it's not as a – I think it would be very unlikely for, say, Pat Murphy, who's had a very successful college coaching career. I can't envision Pat working his way up the minors and eventually becoming the Padres manager one day.
No, I could see him as a major league manager, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think the first good college job that comes open after his NCAA inquiry is done with, he will be a college coach again.
Oh, so. I agree with you. I'm just saying, that's the thing. Is he really going to put in, say 5 years in the minors, rising up the ladder? Or is he going to take that college job, where he can be the guy and it's shit. I mean, when you're a minor league manager, you're a lot of ways you're doing what the organization tells you to do. You're not trying to win games or, able to, go with your hunches. It's a totally different job. So I think I'm with you, John. I think it's more attractive. You make more money, you have more power, you get more fame as a college coach.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty easy call there, but I'm looking forward to seeing the Pat Murphy experience in the short season Northwest League. That's going to be fun. Michael Kilborn in Seattle really enjoyed our draft review on the podcast. We wanted to see basically how we did in 2005, Jim, and I didn't even think to prepare for this question like I should have. That's my mistake. So we might have to get...
What's his question? What does he want to know?
We graded the drafts. So we picked our top 5 drafts, basically. He wants to know what drafts we said were the best ones in 2005. And I thought I would have this question in the office, but I'm recording this in the home office, I don't have my binder here for 2005. So
I'm looking here real quick. Actually, I will go online. We had our best draft was the Marlins, followed by the Red Sox, Diamondbacks, Cardinals, and Athletics.
Okay. That actually is online. How about that? I didn't know.
Look over and figure out who those teams drafted.
Well, the Red Sox at 2, that's easy. That's Clay Buchholz, Jed Lowry, Jacoby Ellsbury.
Craig Hansen was our draft report card photo on the website.
He was, and that one did not quite work out as well.
But so I think that one definitely has stood the test of time. I mean, that's one of the better drafts, you know.
Of the decade, yeah. No, it is one of the best ones. How about that Marlins draft?
The Marlins pick to see who we liked in that Marlins draft. Here we go. Marlins went with, and the thing is, that was here, the Marlins had a million first-round picks. And it's funny because, and I say this all the time, I mean, those rankings, when we do them, are based kind of on how much value you got at the time. How much value you got compared to what an average team theoretically pull out. But you look at this Marlins draft now, you got first-round pick Chris Volstead, who's been okay. You have first-round picks Aaron Thompson and Jacob Marceau, who've never played in the big leagues. You've got sandwich picks Ryan Tucker and Sean West, who've been disappointments.
But you did have Gabby Sanchez in the fourth round, who had a very nice big league rookie season this year. So you've basically gotten two useful big leaguers in Volstead and Sanchez.
Well, their best pick was actually Logan Morrison in the 22nd round.
There you go. That's
what I
was heading.
And I would bet at the time,
we didn't even factor
in this, that we did not necessarily cite Logan Morrison as a guy to keep an eye on. So that one, I guess, looks better because Logan Morrison was hanging out down there. And then, their third draft, we had the Diamondbacks is one of the best drafts. And one of the reasons we had the Diamondbacks one of the best drafts was they had the number one overall pick in the draft in Justin Upton.
The rest of that draft, not so hot.
I don't think he's quite delivering all his potential, but is still, he's pretty young.
Micah Owings.
Behind him, they had Matt Tora, who was hurt and didn't never really panned out. And, they had guys like Micah Owings, Greg Smith. That's pretty much going to be the Justin Upton draft when all is said and done.
Yeah, the two fringy pitchers and then the Justin Upton draft. And Cardinals and A's were the other two, top five drafts we ranked that year. And I don't think the A's, that was the one with those three high school pitchers.
The Cardinals draft, I think,
pretty
will stand
good.
Up because it had Colby Rasmus and they got Jaime Garcia in the 22nd round.
And that was, we did like Jaime Garcia even way back then.
Yeah, I mean, he was a guy who came out. They're going to have, it looks like, at least seven big leaguers. They did not hit on six-rounder Wilfredo Pujols, one of the all-time relative overdrafts. That was a guy who was not a very good high school player in the St. Louis area, but they drafted him in the sixth round to make Albert happy.
And then with the Athletics, Cliff Pennington, their first pick. I know you were always higher on Cliff Pennington than I was, but he's having a nice big league career. Solid shortstop. Not great, but solid. Travis Buck is a mystery. Not sure what happened to him. Great rookie year and then nothing since then. Craig Italiano, Jared Lansford, and Vin Mazzaro. 4 years after Moneyball. I mean, Moneyball won't go away. The Giants bringing it up. I guess Tony Siegel bringing it up after the World Series. I wish we'd all just let it go. But the three high school pitchers they drafted that year, none of those guys have really worked out until recently with Mazzaro kind of coming on. And the rest of that draft really didn't bring you a whole lot either to Oakland. So,
the best guy they probably picked was Justin Smoak, and
they didn't sign him.
I think they offered him, I want to say, $950,000. It was something in the nines, and he wanted $1 million and went to school over, went to school together.
Yeah, the story I always heard was $850,000 was their final offer, and that he didn't, he wanted $1 million. So over that $150,000, he did not sign. But so there you go. I mean, that's.
So
I would say that.
We salvaged that question. We did a fine job of salvaging that question on the fly.
I would say the Red Sox looked the best at retrospect from that 2005 draft. So, Michael Kilbourn, thanks for the question. We've got Jerry. I think we may have answered this last time. We're talking about the Blue Jays. I think we actually answered that question last time. So, Jerry, forgive me. If we did answer it, email me and let me know. We have Michael McAvaney. Out of Glen Rock, New Jersey, what kind of drafts should the Mets expect under the new Sandy Alderson regime? He has a couple other long pitchers, You know, we won't go into that. A very long question, I should say, about their pitchers. What kind of drafts do you expect? The Mets, Jim, apparently going to hire Paul DePodesta as their assistant general.
They hired him and J.P. Richard. I would think.
But Paul DePodesta specifically is scouting and farm director, basically.
Right. Or at least vice president. I don't know if they'll hire a scouting director under him. But all three of those guys have leaned heavily towards college players. So I would expect them to draft, you know, at least have a college flavor to their draft. I mean, I think the big question with the Mets is how much are they going to be allowed to spend? It's not a matter of not having money. It's a matter of the owner buying into what Bud Selig sells about not spending on the draft. And there's no question it hurts the franchise. And that's the big question. And, I mean, you would assume that – well, you know, you'd assume that whoever would take the job would say, look, I've got to spend more on the draft, except, you know, Sandy Alderson was really the architect of the slotting system, you know, 10, 12 years ago when he worked in the commissioner's office. So – I have no feel for how they're going to draft until somebody tells me how much money they're going
to
spend.
But you know what? If he follows form of the other guy who helped try to hold down bonuses, Frank Coonerly, and the Mets are going to spend like crazy, like the Pirates have.
Well, I guess the difference there is Frank was just doing what he was told.
Right. You know, no, it was Sandy's job.
Talks about the irony that Frank now is showing how valuable draft is, whereas I think this is something Sandy Alderson believes in. So
no, I agree.
We will see. I'm not convinced until we see otherwise. I'll put it this way. They may spend more. I'll believe that they're going to throw their financial weight around
when I see it.
When it happens. I'm not convinced it's going to happen.
I'm with you. Well, what questions do you have, Jim, and then we'll wrap this up.
Okay, well, we'll go lightning round on these because I threw out that we were going to talk mainly about Yankees and Red Sox. So I just have Twitter names here. So Wes Yee wants to know what the future holds for Lars Anderson. Is there still all-star potential there? And the same questions regarding Justin Smoke and Brett Wallace. I mean, I guess if you wanted to dream, you know, you could maybe dream Lars Anderson has some all-star potential in there. I just don't think that's a realistic projection right now. His year was not as bad as it may have looked because he hit a little better toward the end of the year in AAA and he tore up AA and he's still young. But, I mean, he's a first baseman who has yet to show much loft in his swing and hit for power. And he's also, you know, just hasn't hit lefty the last 2 years. So he's one of those guys I think it's going to be very difficult for him to get an opportunity in Boston unless he really turns it up. And what do you think about Smoke and Wallace, John?
That's a good question. I believe a little bit more in Brett Wallace, I think, than you do. I really think that, you know, he's a pure hitter. I know he doesn't always look the part, but the guy's always hit. I think he's going to hit. I do question the power. And I got more questions on the athleticism of Justin Smoke this year than I'd ever had before. And that really gives me pause. So I wonder about that one. For me, I would take Justin Smoke there because I do believe in his power more than Brett Wallace's. But neither one of those guys is a sure thing. And I really thought they were both going to be very productive big leaguers. And right now I'd say the chances are only one of them becomes a productive big leaguer. What do you think?
I would take Smoke over Wallace. It bothered me that Wallace struck out a lot this year.
Right,
I
agree.
Trying to hit for power to change who he was.
Right.
And I haven't given up on Smoke, but I was kind of disappointed by the way his year went. I would still take him. I still think he is all-star potential. To me, I just wonder about Wallace really hitting for power, although I think it'll be amplified somewhat by playing in Houston. And I see Wallace maybe more as closer to a solid regular than really an all-star, whereas I thought that he had more all-star potential in the past. Next question comes from Jay Destro, who wants to know, has the Yankees' pitching depth eclipsed the Red Sox farm system? I'm kind of confused by the comparison, but I think, John, based on what we talked about, the Yankees, we both think the Yankees have a little bit better farm system than the Red Sox right now, and that the strength of their farm system is pitching depth.
I think that's very fair to say. The other strength of the Yankee system is catching. You know, they have three in the top 10. I still think Austin Romine is going to be a solid average big league regular. I don't think he's going to be a star. I didn't think he was going to be a star last year when we ranked him second. He just was in a better year in the farm system this year than last. I really haven't changed my opinion on Austin Romine, and I was impressed with him in the fall league. You know, the scouts I talked to out there about Austin Romine also were encouraged by him. And for a guy playing like games 120, 130 of the year as a catcher, you know, they thought he was, you know, holding up pretty well, receiving well, throwing very well. Got a 1.85 pop time on him on last Friday. So I thought I think Austin Romine Gary Sanchez, Jesus Montero. You know, if Austin Romine were in the Red Sox system, he would have a chance to be their starting big league catcher next year. Let's face it. They're desperate for catching in Boston if they don't bring Martinez back. And, you know, Romine's almost a luxury right now to the Red Sox, to the Yankees. I think the Yankee system is stronger, and the main reason for that is pitching. But they also have, you know, catching, which is a coveted position to have. Down the list, J.R. Murphy probably won't catch, but he's a decent prospect. Kyle Higashioka is a very good catch and throw guy, has a chance to hit enough to be a big league, like a Cervelli type, a bit better version of Frank Cervelli. For me, you know, that the other thing to factor in there was we thought the Rangers were loaded with catching 2 years ago, Jim, and look how that worked out. So,
you could, if you wanted to take a pessimistic view, you could look at it and say, well, Jesus Montero might not wind up behind the plate. You know, Gary Sanchez still has a lot of work to do.
Yeah, he's in rookie
ball. You just never know. You know, that's why, you know, we get that kind of version of that question, you know, hey, this team is loaded this position. What should they do or should they avoid drafting guys at that position? You know, what looks like your strength now very well might not be a strength 2 years down the road.
That's true. Very true.
Those things change. Okay, now we have Will Wood, Boston, wants to know, is asking us, who has the most trade value in the Red Sox system among players not ranked in their top five prospects? And that's kind of a tough question in that, I mean, most of these lists, the guys who have the most trade value are going to be the guys at the top of your list. I mean, that said, I think the obvious answer would be the guys at that point who are, A, ranked the highest, or B, are the closest to the big leagues. And for the Red Sox, that would probably be guys like Felix DuBront, you know, Josh Reddick. But again, if they're going to go make a blockbuster, you know, Adrian Gonzalez deal,
right,
I don't think Josh Reddick or Felix DeBron's going to be the headliner.
Correct.
In the deal. You're going to have to trade. Yeah, you know, it'll be interesting. I don't know if the Red Sox – I really don't think they'd want to trade Casey Kelly, and I really think the Padres love Casey Kelly because Jason McLeod and Jed Hoyer were with Boston when they drafted him.
Right.
But, you know, you could conceivably maybe do, depending on how determined they are to trade him, you know, Anthony Rizzo and Drake Britton and a couple other guys. But, again, I mean, I think on any list, your top trade guys are your guys ranked the highest on the list.
Yeah, no, I can't disagree with you there. Other questions that we had, the Yankees farm took a huge leap forward this year, says ready to scrumble. Do you expect to see any regression next year? I'm not a math guy, but I understand what he's trying to say. To me, the reason the Yankee system was so bad in 2009 relative to how good it was in 2010 was in 2010 was injuries. You know, Bragman was coming off Tommy John. He got healthy in 2010 and was further away from the injury. Same thing with Dellin Betances. Same thing with Brett Marshall. And they had a good draft in 2009. I like their 2009 draft, and some of those guys really came through. 2008, they didn't sign Garrett Cole. They didn't sign Scott Biddle in the second round. You know, Jeremy Bleich was their highest signed pick, and he was even hurt this year. So I think it's just natural that the things lined up for them to be better in 2010. I don't expect significant regression in 2011. I mean, it might get better. What if their 2010 draftees, guys like Mason Williams and Cito Culver and Angelo Gomes, have good debuts in 2011? What if those guys all go out and show some hitting ability where really they're more athletes first and the hit tool is secondary? So I don't think it's necessarily true that their system will take a step back next year. I do think the odds of all their pitchers, really other than Jeremy Bleich, all their pitchers who they were kind of counting on, all had good years in 2010. The chances of that happening again in 2011 are less. They're probably not going to repeat that. So, but, you know, can Manny Banuelos be better in 2011? Yeah, he can. He went 0-4 this year and only threw 60 innings. It'll be a big step forward if Manny Banuelos throws 130, 140 innings in 2011. I really like Manny Banuelos. I think Yankee fans are almost getting a little too overheated on Manny Banuelos. He's not going to be in the big leagues in 2011. I don't think he's ever pitched more than 110 innings in a season. The Yankees have mishandled the transition to the big leagues with Jabba Chamberlain, with Phil Hughes, the guys there was more hype and who had better stuff than Manny Banuelos. Banuelos has more poise than those guys, but he's only 19. I just don't see him in the big leagues in 2011. I think Yankee fans need to just temper their expectations a little bit, and let's see if he can maintain this quality of stuff, 3-plus pitches, over 130 to 150 innings. When he does that, he'll be ready for the big leagues. Until then, he's very, very good, but, I mean, I'm just not ready to call him the next whatever. You know, I like him a lot, but I think there's reason to be cautious about Banuelos as well, that seems to be getting forgotten here. But I think that there's a, I think this, it makes sense if you think about it in the big picture of why the Yankee system took a leap forward in 2010. They got healthier, and they signed their first round pick in 2009 and signed most of their draft picks, whereas in 2008 they had two high unsigned picks.
Well, I think the interesting thing, I agree with you, John. I mean, I think the easy answer is if you had a year where you had good health and guys performed well, is that you come back to the pack and, you know, the Red Sox didn't have as good health and some of their guys were very young, didn't perform as well. They might perform a little better next year. But I think the interesting thing to me for the Yankees farm system next year is, you know, this year was such a good year in terms, you know, Ben Wallace didn't pitch a lot because he had the appendectomy. But in terms of Ben Wallace's stuff got better.
Right.
And Betances and Brackman got healthier and made a lot of strides. Okay, are all those guys for real?
Correct.
It's going to be very interesting to see. You know, if those guys continue to build on what they did in 2010, those guys could be very, very exciting in 2011. And if they don't, then the expectations are going to be tempered a little bit. We have another Twitter question, John, from Crink0836.
Yeah, he copied me on that one as well.
He wants to know if we would take Manny Ben Wallace or Casey Kelly. And I will let you go first.
You know, I love Manny Ben Wallace. But I'm a Casey Kelly guy like you are. I would take Casey Kelly. I just think there's a little bit more upside there. You know, that's a very good question, but I would take Casey Kelly.
And I would take Kelly too. And I'll just give my short spiel on Kelly. I think it's kind of funny that a year ago he had a tremendous year, considering that he hadn't even pitched professionally, not even in an instruction league going into the year. Had a tremendous year, and people, it seemed like fans were complaining, his stuff, you know, these scouting reports don't blow me away.
Right.
This stuff doesn't sound that great. So then this year, you know, they jumped him to Double A at age 20 with a half season of pitching experience behind him as a professional. And, you know, he did not have a great statistical year, but, you know, he put on 15 pounds. His fastball was in the low 90s consistently. His changeup looks like it will be a plus pitch down the road. I mean, his curveball will be pretty good. He just didn't have the same command. All of a sudden, it was like, well, performance isn't any good, even though the stuff was a lot better. And I just think, you know, he's 20 years old. You know, like a lot of these guys are very young, and he's going to put it back together. You know, he'll have the polish he used to have with the improved stuff, and I think that makes for an exciting pitcher.
I agree.
And I like Ben Wallace, too. The one thing I'd like to see with him is, even though it wasn't an arm injury, you can't hold the appendectomy against him.
Right.
I'd like to see him do it for a full minor league season. You know, the year before he showed some flashes, and I want to say, John, in 09, I want to say he faded a little bit late, and I think they even finished him in the bullpen.
Well, he wasn't fading. He was up against their innings limit, and that's the thing. And now he's at Double A, so now he's going to be in Double A next year because he's had success at that level. He's going to go to Double A, never having pitched more than 110 innings in a season, and they're going to go, okay, repeat it, do it all for 150 innings. And I do the Yankees and I do the Twins, among other organizations I have done. The Twins and the Yankees couldn't handle these things differently. Kyle Gibson was injured in 2009, barely pitched in instructs, goes out and throws 153 innings this year, including in AAA. Now, granted, he's a little bit older, but the Twins want him to be ready for 2011. So what do? They push him. They pushed him to the limit. He threw a lot of innings. Look at the Giants. This year, as a 21-year-old, Madison Bumgarner threw close to 220 innings. The Yankees do not do that. They baby their pitchers. There's no other way to put it. They baby their pitchers. And as a result, they had big questions about would Phil Hughes be ready in the postseason this year. He had a great start against the Twins, but wasn't very good in the LCS. None of their other starting pitchers who've had some hype have worked out. And Jabba Chamberlain's one of the biggest disappointments of the last couple of years. And I think a big reason for it is the way they've handled him and the way they handled him in the big leagues, the Jabba rules and all that. So, you know, to me, the Yankees have got Ben Wallace, Betances. That's the one thing Brackman did. I'm more of a believer in Brackman in some ways than the Yankees are. You know, he threw more innings this year. He grinded through a horrible season in 2009. I think he deserves credit for not packing it in. He was awful that year, and he still improved at the end of the year when they put him in the bullpen. And the Yankees don't seem to leave their guys to throw 150, 160 innings in the minor leagues. And I think it's a good idea to do that. And the Twins' track record for developing pitchers is better than New York's. And one of the reasons I think it's better is they work their guys in the minor leagues. And that's where you learn to pitch tired. I'd rather you learn to pitch tired in Rochester or Scranton than in the LCS against the Rangers. Wouldn't you?
Yeah, no, I agree.
So to me, that's a huge question. I think the Yankees, I think the Red Sox pitching program looks pretty good when you see John Lester and Clay Buchholz doing what they're doing. So I have more faith in the Red Sox ability to bring it out of Casey Kelly than I do in the Yankees ability to bring it out of Manny Benuelos as well. So that needs to be factored in there. And then we'll end with Japers. We started off with Joe Lacates. We should end with Japers, Jim. Japers413 on Twitter. State your case why you think your top 30 has more depth than the other ones. I don't think you're going to argue the Red Sox have more depth than the Yankees, do you?
No, I think the Red Sox do have more depth than the Yankees.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll say that
I'll let you go first, then.
Okay. The Yankees.
I'll throw out there again. I think when you do an organization that has talent, if I did the Yankees and you did the Red Sox, we might have opposite opinions. So
that's probably true. That's a good point. I think I'm going to say, as I try to find my old handbook, I'm going to say that the Yankees' position player depth, I think, is a little bit better than you're giving it credit for. I think one of the things I like about the Yankees' position players, they have some guys at every level. AAA, you have Montero, and then I think you're selling Eduardo Nunez short. I think if the Royals had Eduardo Nunez, they'd be going insane with happiness, or the Mariners. I think Eduardo Nunez is a solid average, has a chance to be a solid average big league shortstop right now. I think you go to the big leagues, be an average defender or a little bit better, and put up a 700, 730 OPS. And that's not a game-changing player, but I think he'd be solid. And I think he could be a very good utility man for the Yankees. Then at AA, you've got Austin Romine. Again, I think he's a solid average regular behind the plate that has significant value. At high A, even there, they have some intriguing guys. Melky Mesa was MVP of that league. I don't love Melky Mesa. I don't even know if he's going to get protected on their 40-man roster. But he's all tooled up. And was MVP of that league. I like their low Class A team, Slade Heathcott. Again, he got all kinds of tools. I like the guys they drafted this year as far as just drafting for athleticism. Mason Williams, the best product of their 2010 draft. Again, Cito Culver. Everyone I've talked to in and out of that organization think he has a chance to play shortstop. And Angelo Gums has some tools. So I think they have, a little bit better, I'm not mentioning J.R. Murphy, some of the other position players. So I think they have a little bit better position player depth than you're giving them credit for. It's not as good as Boston's, but pitching-wise, I don't think there's a question. The Yankees' pitching depth is vastly superior, and I think it's probably as good a pitching depth as any organization has in baseball right now. And again, to me, especially when you're talking about trades, the number one commodity is minor league pitching. And the Yankees have it, and that's why their system is better. Plus, on top of it all, Jesus Montero. So there's my case. What's yours?
Well, we're not talking number one prospects.
I know we're talking
Montero
about depth.
For Kelly, but I guess my argument would almost be the exact reverse of yours, John. Is that I think the difference in pitching. I think the Yankees do have better pitching. I still, like I said, I want to see Manny Benuelos do it for a full minor league season. I want Betances and Brackman to do it for more than a couple months at a time. I want to see them do it for a full year and build on what they did this year. I'm still not convinced those guys aren't relief pitchers. And, the Red Sox have Kelly. From a pitching standpoint, they have Anthony Renato, who's one of the better pitchers in this year's draft. They have Drake Britton, a left-hander who's flown under the radar because he's come back from Tommy John. I think he's going to take off. They have Dubron, who pitched in the big leagues this year and looked very good doing so. They have Stolmy Pimentel, who is in the futures game. You have guys like Alex Wilson and Brandon Workman, who have very good arms. Madison Jungner, who's more of a project. But, I think they do have some pitching depth there, too. And I just think they're deep and up-the-middle players. Not so much a catcher, where they have guys like Ryan LaVarnway and Tim Fedorovich and Luis Exposito. Those guys, they don't compare at all to the Yankees' catching depth. But I think otherwise, I like the Red Sox position play. I like their middle infielders better than I like the Yankees.
I do, too.
Outfielders better than I like the Yankees. I think they're deeper. I don't think their top 10 is necessarily as strong right now, or at least didn't have as good a years as a lot of the Yankees guys did. I think a lot of that, too, is that the Red Sox players, the Red Sox farm system, I don't have a way of calculating this without doing hours of work, but I think they might have had the youngest full season affiliates of any team in baseball. And as a result, they didn't necessarily put up numbers that some of the other organizations did.
I think that's fair. That's actually a great question for an intern to tackle, and we've got an intern, so I think we'll have her tackle that. That would be cool to have in the handbook. But
I know when I was looking at it, you just using Baseball Reference, The Red Sox top five affiliates, not counting the Gulf Coast League, three of their affiliates were the youngest in the league. And Greenville, which went to the South Atlantic League finals, was the second youngest team in their league. So,
there you go. That's
yeah, it's just, I mean, they draft a lot of high school players. And, you know, I thought they had another good draft this year, too, and added a lot more talent to the organization as well. So,
I do think,
with this prospect stuff, you can argue a lot of different ways. And I do think, in terms of depth, I bet if I did the Yankees and you did the Red Sox, we might very well be arguing it from the other side. So.
I think you're right about that. We're both more informed about those organizations than we are about others.
What do you think? I mean, I don't know if I've ever estimated, but I mean, when you're doing a top 30, what do you think you spend in terms of say research plus talking to people? What, 10, 15 hours?
Probably more than that.
Yeah, I've never really tried to count it. So, I mean, I if I'm talking to people about, I think there's this misperception out there, or at least in some areas that, hey, the lists come from the team or the Yankees and Red Sox tell us who to rank. Well, we talk to so many people who aren't in either organization about players, in the organizations, you get so many different opinions that, I'm sitting here getting, five different guys telling me, varying degrees that they like Kyle Weiland. And you probably aren't talking to anybody about Kyle Weiland at all.
That's right.
Although he may have come up in the Eastern League. Or, you might be talking to, however many guys you talked to about Adam Warren, and he didn't intersect with any of my prospect coverage this year. So I just think you get a much better feel. Sometimes you hear more bad things about players too, but you hear more positives about guys just because you're doing that organization.
That's very true. I think sometimes you almost hear more negatives.
It just depends on the claim. Doing the White Sox organization.
That's right.
I think you'd probably be very down on them. I mean, not that they're – I don't think they're as high on them right now anyway. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, the more focus you spend, I think it just it pulls out,
that's
if it's
it.
A good organization or bad organization.
The more you focus on it, the
more – more.
That's it. You find a trend, and sometimes that trend is kind of you just chew over it over and over and over again. You know, 3 years ago, the Twins, the first year to the Twins, or second year to the Twins, where they just didn't have a number one prospect. In retrospect, he could have gone with Denard Span, could have gone with Wilson Ramos, could have gone with Joe Benson. I went with Nick Blackburn. They really didn't have anybody. Denard Span had a terrible year the year before. So those are the kind of years where, the more I looked at it, the more I was like, I don't have a number one. And it just became kind of this... it was just this giant obstacle to get over, I think sometimes that happens. Last year with the Yankees, the more you asked about guys, it was like, well, he was hurt. Well, he wasn't as good as he was last year. And you just, just keeps getting in your head that it was a bad year. And sometimes it's hard to shake those trends or that mentality. It's hard to pull back and get the big picture. But that's why you talk to people outside the organization, not just in the organization as well. So, Jim, I think this is the longest podcast in Baseball America history.
I'm about to expire. I was hungry when we began, and starving now, and I will have to rectify that as soon as we're done.
Well, I will let that be now. It was a Baseball America podcast with John Manuel and Jim Callis, brought to you by MLB Network. $4 for 4 issues of the Baseball America magazine. Go to baseballamerica.com/MLB Network for that special MLB Network offer. And Jim, thanks for all the time. Now go get some lunch.
I will do that. Thanks, John.
Okay, for Jim, I'm John. We'll talk to you next time on the Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.